With his shoulders hunched and his head down, he fit right in with everyone else. Just based on the time of day, Harvath had assumed Tretyakov was headed to his office, but as they neared the river, he watched him take a detour. Up ahead was a short bridge covered with padlocks. On the other side was Naipov, the 25-acre island Kuznetsov had told him about, Tretyakov's quiet place, where he sought refuge when he needed to get away from the office. It seemed odd to be starting the day there, but who could say? Perhaps he just enjoyed passing through on his way to work. As Harvath watched the man cross the bridge, he unslung his backpack and removed a brightly colored guidebook. He opened to the section on Immanuel Kant and Königsberg Cathedral. Then, once he had felt he had given the GRU officer enough of a lead, he began following him again. Aside from a smattering of vagrants and occasional people cutting through, either on foot or by bicycle, the park was relatively quiet. The scent of the river was strong and unpleasant. Harvath could only imagine what it was like at the height of summer. But despite that, the island appeared to be an enjoyable and likely a popular place. It was filled with trees, there were open places to sunbathe or play soccer, there were plenty of benches, and in addition to the cobbled boulevard that ran up the center, there were a multitude of walking paths that branched off in all directions. Harvath watched as Tretyakov passed the cathedral and the Kant tomb, then took a path that branched off to the right. At the first bench he came to, he sat down. Placing his briefcase on his left side, he took out an envelope that the babushka had given him. Opening it, he removed the letter from inside and began to read. At that moment, another impulse fired from deep inside Harbath's brain. Looking around and not seeing anything suspicious, he decided to take Tretyakov right there in the park. Chapter 67 Harvath walked up and stopped right in front of Tretyakov. For several moments, the Russian didn't even bother to look up from his letter. Once he did, he spoke in English.
"Mr. Stephen Hall, I presume," he said, using Harvath's alias from Gotland.
"You can call me Steve."
Returning the letter to its envelope, Tretyakov placed it in an outer pocket of his briefcase and studied the man standing in front of him.
"It's a little early in the morning for that, isn't it?" the GRU officer asked, eyeballing the empty vodka bottle Harvath had fished from a nearby trash can.
"This isn't for me. It's for you. In fact, you're going to be holding on to it in a moment."
"You think so?"
Harvath nodded. In his pack was a syringe of ketamine, known for its use as a horse tranquilizer. He had planned on hitting him with the taser, and then injecting him with the ketamine to make it look as if he had passed out drunk. As soon as he had him incapacitated, he would work on getting him out of the park and back to the abandoned building.
"Mr. Hall, or whatever your real name is, I'm afraid I cannot help you."
The man was incredibly calm. He sat on the bench as if he didn't have a care in the world. Though Harvath hadn't shown it to him, he assumed that the hand he couldn't see, the one hidden in his right coat pocket, was grasping a weapon.
"I think you're going to be a lot of help to me," said Harvath, pulling out his taser.
"Close in, now,"
Tretyakov ordered in Russian. The sudden switch from English jarred Harvath. Instantly, his head was on a swivel. Four vagrants were now headed toward him from different directions, as were two more passers-by. All had weapons drawn. It was a trap.
"Sometimes things are too good to pass up," said Tretyakov. "Like a GRU colonel, sitting alone on a bench in a quiet section of a quiet park."
"There's no way you could have known I was coming."
"I didn't. It was a hunch, I believe you Americans call it. When Ivan failed to make contact, we assumed the worst. We knew eventually he would be broken. We just didn't know when. I must thank you, though."
"For what?"
"I didn't think we would catch you so quickly. We were worried we might have to carry on this ruse for quite some time."
Harvath shook his head.
"Only six men? That's all?"
Apparently, that's all we needed.
When the first of the GRU operatives, a bald, muscular man with a scar along the side of his head, got within striking distance, he took Harvath down hard. Wrenching his arm behind his back, he placed him in handcuffs, left him on the ground, and patted him down. Relieving him of his taser, he tossed it to a colleague who was going through his backpack. Harvath heard the Russian word for spy several times as they laid out all of the contents, including his weapons, on the bench and examined them. The man patting him down took his phone, his watch, his flashlight, all of his cash, and the two knives he was carrying. He then stood guard over him, placing his boot on top of his neck and pushing down with an unnecessary amount of force in order to create the maximum amount of pain possible. It radiated throughout his skull. He had never felt anything like it. Just as his vision was beginning to dim, Tretyakov yelled for the goon to knock it off. The man dialed it back from an 11 to an 8. The pain was still white hot. If he kept at it, Harvath was going to end up with permanent damage. Tretyakov had to yell again. This time, the man obliged, removing his boot completely from Harvath's neck. Then, when his boss wasn't looking, he dug it into Harvath's left shoulder blade, creating an all-new kind of agony. As exquisite as the pain was, Harvath didn't give the asshole the satisfaction of making a single sound. Finally, they replaced everything in the backpack, and Tretyakov gave the command to get Harvath to his feet. Asshole used the handcuffs to do it, adding even more injury to Harvath's shoulders, particularly the left one. They then walked him back in the direction from where they had come. At the cathedral, they turned left and walked toward the back, where several cars were parked. The brutality of the Russians when it came to interrogations was legendary. If what had just happened to him was any indication, and he had every reason to believe it was, the nightmare hadn't even started yet. Everything he had ever been taught about escape and evasion flooded back into his brain. He knew that he had to keep his wits about him. If he lost his head, he might miss an opportunity. Already he had managed to reach down to the hem of his coat, tear the inside seam, and remove the plastic handcuff key he had sewn inside. All he needed now was an opportunity. It would probably come once he was inside a car. Judging by the group of vehicles he was being led toward, they were all sedans. That meant the GRU team would have to split up. It also meant that Harvath would have fewer guards to deal with. Stepping into the parking area, Harvath took a deep breath and tried to loosen his body. Extricating himself was going to be incredibly difficult, and depending upon whether there were cars ahead or behind his, he would probably have only seconds to decide which direction to run. His chances for success were not good. Not only that, but all he could do at this point was escape. There was no way he could also take Tretyakov. The operation was a failure, and it was his fault. Had he waited, had he not been so impulsive, it might have succeeded. As these thoughts raced through his mind, Harvath didn't realize that he had slowed down and was shuffling across the pavement. The bald goon gave him a shove, and that was when it happened. There was a crack, followed by a spray of blood, as one of the GRU operatives went down. Chapter 68. Harvath had time to unlock only one hand. Whipping his arm hard to the left, he used the open handcuff like a mace and tore a giant gash right across asshole's forehead, nose, and cheek. As the man's hands flew to his face, Harvath pulled the GRU operative's pistol from his holster and shot him twice in the chest and once in the head. Turning to the next operative, he did the same. He turned to engage a third, but before he could, the man took two rounds to the head and dropped dead to the ground. Looking around him, Harvath counted six bodies. There was blood and brains and bits of bone everywhere. As quickly as it had started, it was over. The GRU had been caught out in the open, without any cover or concealment. Each of the operatives had gotten his ticket punched. The most important GRU person, though, was gone. "Hurry!" Chase yelled, as he, Stalin, and Ashby stepped out from behind the vehicles. "Tretyakov took off!" Harvath had no idea how they had gotten there or how they had set up such a quick ambush, but now wasn't the time to ask. Spinning around, he could see Tretyakov disappearing into the park's trees. The man had shed his briefcase and was running fast. Even with the head start, Harvath was confident that he could catch him, and he took off running. This was what he had been training for. All the squats, all the hellacious early morning runs, all the wind sprints, and all the Hulk sauce, it all came down to this. He had pushed his body to the limit, so that when it counted most, he could prove he was not only still in the game, but deserved to be here. With every stride he grew closer. Tretyakov didn't stand a chance. Short of turning around and firing a gun at him, which he would have done by now if he could, Harvath had him. Twice the man had looked over his shoulder and the fear was evident in his face. Gone was the cool customer on the bench. He had been replaced by a scared animal, running for its life. The apex predator was in his prime, and he was about to prove once again why he occupied the top of the pyramid. Harvath had never felt as alive, as purposeful, as he did at that moment. He had this, and a smile swept across his face. Then he heard the roar of a car engine, followed by a quick double tap on a horn. As Sloane raced past him in one of the GRU sedans, she winked and flashed him the thumbs up. Rocketing ahead of Harvath, she caught up to Tretyakov, jerked the wheel quickly to the right, and sent him tumbling across the ground. When he got to them, she already had him flex-cuffed.
"You can make goo-goo eyes at him later," she cracked, as he stood there, mouth slightly agape. "Come on, help me get him into the car."
Harvath obliged, and after seat-belting him in, hopped in the back with him.
"We gone,"
stated Sloane, peeling out before Harvath's door was even closed.
"Has anybody discussed a plan?"
asked Harvath as she pinned the accelerator to the floor.
"The plan is that we get the hell out of here."
Across the river, Harvath could see the flashing lights from approaching police cars.
"Good plan," he said.
Sloane blasted past the cathedral, where Stalin and Palmer peeled out in another GRU sedan right behind them.
"Any other sights you wanted to see before we left town?" she asked.
"Nope," replied Harvath. "All good."
"Okay, buckle up."
Harvath fastened his seatbelt as she sped across the bridge, pulled up her emergency brake, and drifted into a hard left turn. The maneuver spat them out onto a wide boulevard, and she dropped the hammer. Weaving in and out of early morning rush hour traffic, she traded paint with buses and all sorts of other vehicles. No matter how dangerous each prior move that she made was, she found a way to top it. Glancing out the rear window, Harvath saw that, amazingly, Chase was right behind.
"Do you two have some sort of ESP?" he asked.
"Google Maps," she said, nodding at her phone, which she had jammed into the dashboard in front of the speedometer.
"Where the hell's our destination?"
he asked, as she barely threaded the needle between two semi-trucks.
"We're going to the pickup point."
"Negative,"
said Harvath from the back seat.
"Not until we have swept the cars."
In the rearview mirror, he could see her roll her eyes.
"The Russians can't even afford new combat boots for all their troops," she said. "You think they'd waste money on tracking GRU vehicles in Kaliningrad?"
She made a good point. Nevertheless, Harvath wanted to be sure.
"Once we're outside of town, pull over. I'm going to check."
"I'll see if we can find a roadside shrine where we can light some candles, too,"
she replied, downshifting and swerving around a tour bus. Harvath looked at Tretyakov, who had wisely kept his mouth shut, but perhaps not because he had any choice. His face was badly battered from the fall he had taken, and based on the swelling that was setting up, Harvath wouldn't have been surprised to learn that he had broken his jaw.
"Tight squeeze,"
Sloane yelled from the front seat, as she maneuvered between a tram and a delivery truck, knocking the mirrors off on both sides. Two blocks later, they reached the on-ramp for the main route that led west out of the city. Sloane hit it hard, but immediately slowed down as she merged with the traffic.
"Everyone keep your eyes open," she said,
partly to Harbath and partly to Stalin and Palmer, whom she had on speakerphone in front of her. The cops Harbath had seen approaching back by the river had probably gone right to the island and were trying to figure out what had happened. The rest of the police force, though, was likely hearing from angry drivers who had called in about two black sedans that had caused damage to multiple vehicles. The good news for Harbath and his team, though, was when the police ran the license plates, they would come back as GRU, and nothing further would be done. No officers would be dispatched to investigate. Only later would they realize that the vehicles had been stolen, and by then, it would be too late for the Russians to do anything at all. Chapter 69. They kept pushing west until Harbath, who had been glued to the rear window, watching to make sure they weren't being followed, felt comfortable enough to give the okay to pull off the road. Up ahead was a small, run-down truck stop, and Sloane suggested they stop there. Harbath concurred. Around the back was a pair of beat-up old dumpsters and a crappy, out-of-service car wash. That was where they parked. Getting out of the cars, they kept their eyes peeled for trouble as they stretched their legs.
"What the fuck were you thinking?" Chase demanded as he approached Harbath.
"I had a bird in the hand," he replied. "I wasn't going to let him go."
"A bird whose nest we had under observation," stated Sloane.
"Sometimes birds don't come back to their nests."
Chase shook his head. So did Sloane. Stalin was unavailable for headshaking, as he had walked over behind the car wash to take a leak.
"We've got Tretyakov," Harbath declared. "That's what matters."
"The ends justify the means," said Chase. "Is that what you're telling me?"
"In this case, absolutely. When you get a shot, you take a shot. It's that simple."
"You're lucky we were there."
"I am lucky," Harbath admitted, not afraid to say it. "Very lucky. But what the hell were you doing there in the first place?"
Chase was neither ashamed nor embarrassed.
"I thought you made a really bad call, so when you left the roof, I decided to follow you."
"Bullshit. I would have known you were behind me."
"Not if I was using the force."
Again with the force, thought Harbath. But there was no arguing with the fact that Chase had indeed followed him, and that Harbath hadn't even realized it. Perhaps his skills were much farther along than Harbath had been giving him credit for. Even so, he wasn't thrilled with Chase's decision to abandon his post on the rooftop. Harbath had been the ultimate rule breaker. It was the foundation of who he was. But now that he had one foot in management and was responsible for people beneath him, he needed his orders to be followed without exception. Hypocrisy at its best, he realized.
"Next time I do something you think is dumb," said Harbath, "don't you do something dumber, okay? In the meantime, thank you."
Chase hadn't been expecting a thank you.
"Seriously?"
"Seriously," Harbath answered. "Thank you."
"Well, you're welcome," he said, and then added, "You also need to thank Ashby and Stalin. They hauled ass to get there. We had no idea what you were up to, but we wanted to have your back in case something went down."
Harbath thanked Ashby, and when Stalin reappeared zipping his fly, he thanked him as well.
"You bet," the Delta Force operative responded. "Gunfight in Kaliningrad is going to make a killer band name."
Harbath smiled.
"Make sure to save me a t-shirt."
Stalin nodded, and remembering he had something for him, reached into his vehicle and pulled out Harvath's backpack.
"Your phone and the other things they took from you are in there, too."
He was doling out a lot of thank yous, but he had a top-notch team, and they deserved every one of them. The presence of mind to clean the scene like that was a testament to their professionalism.
"Thank you," he said.
"You're welcome," replied Stalin.
Looking at the damage on both cars, he added, "We need to get rid of these vehicles." Harbath agreed, but first he wanted to confirm they weren't already being tracked. They swept each of the GRU sedans and didn't find any tracking devices. That was the good news. The bad news was that their pickup point was at least 45 minutes away, and that was if they took the most direct route. The direct route, though, wasn't an option. Not for them. If it hadn't happened already, police and military throughout the exclave would soon be alerted. Patrols at the border would be stepped up, as well as along all the roads. The longer they were out in the open, especially during the daytime, the greater the likelihood was that they were going to get caught. They had to go into hiding. Now. Glancing over at the defunct car wash, Harvath got an idea. There had been just enough room to get both cars inside and still close the metal roll-down door. Harvath used the Dermabond from his med kit to make the broken lock look as if it had never been touched. They each still had water and protein bars, and there were drains in the floor should anyone need to relieve themselves. Though no one felt like sleeping, Harvath still posted a guard rotation. It was important that they be prepared for anything. The next thing he needed to do was burst an update and request a change in the pickup point and the time. He didn't like risking the exposure, but inside the windowless car wash, without an unobstructed view of the sky, he wouldn't be able to get a signal. He had Sloan, with her suppressed H&K VP9 pistol, cover him as he placed a small vehicle-mounted satellite antenna outside and then surreptitiously ran the cord back inside. It was a calling card that, if discovered, would announce their presence, but he didn't have a choice. Without comms, they were dead in the water. Retreating inside, he attached the antenna, burst the message to Ryan, and then shut everything off. Under the guise of combating terrorism, Moscow monitored satellite communications throughout Russia and its territories. While terrorism was a legitimate concern, the effort was more about controlling free speech and blunting espionage. Whatever was being said at any time, anywhere, the Kremlin wanted to know it. The position was so draconian that even foreign visitors were mandated to purchase Russian SIM cards for their satellite phones or face fines and potential imprisonment. Compressing his message and sending it in a short, fast burst was designed to avoid detection and have the lowest probability of intercept. Even if the Russians noticed, there'd be no way for them to trace it. With the message sent, all they could do was wait. They were used to it. Being good at waiting made you good at the game. And they needed to be good at the game if they were going to get out of Kaliningrad alive. In fact, they were going to need to be great. Chapter 70. Lake Goldup, Poland. Mike Haney sat down on the outdoor terrace of the Hotel Mazurach, ordered a beer from the waitress, and once she was gone, filled Barton and Yashinsky in on his brief reconnaissance operation. "I'm actually more worried about the Polish side of the border than the Russian side," he said. "Based on what I could see, they're using a lot of high-tech equipment to detect illegal crossings, lasers, infrared, that kind of thing. There are also foot and vehicle patrols, including 4x4s.
"That's because Poland acts as a border for the EU, said Yashinsky. "They've put a lot of money into security here.
"You can say that again. All the buildings are brand new. The difference between the Polish side and the Russian side is pretty stark.
"How about the lake itself? Asked Barton.
"That's the good part. All they have is a line of buoys marking the border and a bunch of signs that say, do not cross.
"Yeah. I'm not a very good reader."
"Me neither," said Haney. "Especially at night."
"How about patrol boats?" said Barton. "Did you see any? Either Russian or Polish?"
"There's no visible presence from either out on the lake, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. The Polish border patrol has a lot of cameras, though, so I imagine they're keeping an eye on the water. But the Russians? Everything I could see looked pretty low-tech."
"Did you get any pictures?"
Haney smiled and patted his camera. "Tons. We'll put them on my laptop and I can show you up in the room."
"Great,"
Barton replied, as the waitress set down Haney's beer and went to take another table's order. Once she was out of earshot, he continued,
"As soon as it gets dark, we can start moving the equipment into place. Monica, you'll come with me."
"As a linguist only," Yashinsky replied, "I don't have any jurisdiction over the border."
"I'm sure if you had to, you could be pretty persuasive," said Barton.
Haney shook his head. Barton would never need Viagra because his erection was permanent. The guy was a walking hard-on, and he'd been eyeing her since they first met. What about my idea for a distraction? Haney asked, bringing the conversation back to the operation.
For the record, she stated, I'm against any destruction of Polish equipment or property.
Duly noted. How about off the record?
Off the record? You'd have to be sure to take out any of their backups, or else what's the point?
Haney nodded and raised his glass.
So it's settled then. You and Barton handle the equipment. I'll be the official pain in everyone's ass and handle the sabotage.
Raising their drinks, Yashinsky and Barton clinked glasses with Haney. If everything went well, they'd be back in 12 hours with the rest of the team, doing the exact same thing. But when it came to complicated assignments, especially one this complicated, things rarely went according to plan. Chapter 71. Kaliningrad. When his next communications window opened, Harvath downloaded Lydia Ryan's message. To her credit, she had kept it short, sweet, and to the point. Per his request, the pickup location and the time had been changed. All they needed to do was stay out of sight until then. That was going to be no problem. With Sloane covering him once more, he took down the antenna and brought everything back inside the car wash. Stalin, who served as the team's de facto medic, had been examining Tretyakov. I think you're right, he said when Harvath came back in. I think his jaw's broken. He's not going to be able to exfil with a broken jaw.
Don't worry about the exfil, said Harvath. I've got it all taken care of. Everything's going to be fine.
As team leader, it was his job to reassure and to instill confidence in his troops. Privately, though, his concern was growing. Twice in the last 2 hours, a police vehicle had done a sweep through the truck stop. The first time it was just a slow roll. The second time, they stopped, got out, and looked in the dumpsters. For their protection, Tretyakov had been carefully duct-taped at the mouth and bound even tighter. They couldn't risk his giving them away. Harvath decided to double the guard, posting someone at each end of the car wash, even though only one of the roll-up doors had a gap big enough to see through. They might be blind at one of their entry points, but they didn't have to be deaf. As he had expected, the alert appeared to have gone out. Since their vehicles had been spotted barreling west out of the city, it wasn't a surprise that the authorities were checking this truck stop. They were likely checking all truck stops, as well as rest stops, bus depots, and train stations, in addition to countless other locations. All Harvath and his team could do right now was to sit tight. Though it felt like an eternity, very soon they'd be on their way, and one step closer to home. When the appointed time neared, Harvath went back and forth about whom to put outside. Sloane was the obvious choice, as a good-looking woman was probably not what the cops were looking for. But a good-looking woman loitering at a truck stop created a whole different sort of potential trouble for the team. That wasn't to say she couldn't handle herself. She absolutely could. But it might very quickly turn into a problem. Instead, Harvath decided to send out Chase. He didn't need to be told to make himself scarce. He was functioning as a lookout. If he could do so from a concealed position, all the better. He found an excellent position behind a stack of discarded pallets. From there, he could see most of the eastern side of the truck stop. That was where the pickup was supposed to occur. The only problem with his position, besides its limited field of sight, was that it afforded no avenues of escape. When the police came back through a third time and decided to do an even more aggressive search, Chase realized it wasn't just him who was in trouble, but his whole team. It didn't take the cops long to find him. Yelling in Russian, they told him to step out from behind the pallets. He obliged them, but just partly, stepping out from behind the stack of pallets, only enough to reveal the left side of his body. When the first cop moved to call it in over his radio, the second cop, standing next to him, went for his gun. That was when Chase fired. His suppressed Glock had been in his right hand the entire time. Firing through the open space in the pallets, he killed both of the Russians instantly. Harvath was the first one out of the car wash to help him scrub the scene.
I'll handle the bodies, he said. You figure out how we get one more vehicle inside.
It was the kind of puzzle the Army gave to its Green Beret recruits, like jeeps with only three wheels that need to be moved right away to a life-or-death location. Rushing back inside the car wash, Chase surveyed the scene and quickly realized that if they slanted the vehicles, they could squeeze one more in, which is exactly what they did. By the time Harvath had put the bodies in the back of the police car and had driven it up to the car wash, a space was ready and waiting for him. Once again, Chase was proving how capable he was. The vehicle secure and no one the wiser, Harvath sent Chase back out to resume his post. Inserting a fresh magazine into his weapon, he did as he was told and headed back outside. 20 minutes later, their ride arrived. He had backed in along the east side so as to make it as easy as possible for Harvath and his team to climb up into his trailer without being seen.
You too,
the Lithuanian truck driver from earlier that morning said. Harvath shook his head.
Nope, I'm riding with you. Let's go.
It wasn't a request. The driver shook his head and, after closing the trailer doors, came back around front and hopped up into the cab. Harvath joined him on the passenger side.
I was almost home, he said, putting his rig in gear and pulling out of the truck stop. Then I get a message that I must turn around and come to get you.
We appreciate it, said Harvath. Thank you.
Tell me the Russians will be unhappy.
Harvath smiled.
I think the Russians will be very unhappy.
The old man smiled back. They rode together without speaking. As the Lithuanian listened to his radio, Harvath put his head back and closed his eyes. He needed to rest up. Their exfil was going to suck. When he felt the truck slow, he opened his eyes and looked at his watch. He had been out for well over an hour.
Where are we?
He asked. The driver pointed to the sign.
10 kilometers from the Polish border. This is as far as I go.
Harvath thanked him, and climbing down from the cab, accompanied him around back to let his teammates out. The driver had several cases of bottled water and encouraged them to take as much as they needed. Stalin made a point to take the driver aside and thank him personally.
You come from a family of warriors. It's an honor to know you. Thank you for helping us.
Normally, in a situation like this, Stalin would have handed the man one of his military challenge coins. This was a covert operation, though, and they weren't carrying anything that could identify them as Americans. But in his boot was a small backup knife designed for Delta operators called the Skiandu. Bending down, he removed it and handed it to the man. The Lithuanian was touched and tried to refuse it, but Stalin insisted. Reaching into his pocket, the man pulled out an aged pocket knife. It had been hand-painted with some sort of a religious icon, probably a saint. It was apparent that he had owned it for a long time. Stalin tried to refuse the gift, but the man insisted, so he relented, accepting it graciously.
Ready to roll?
Harvath asked, interrupting the moment between Stalin and the descendant of the Forrest brothers.
Yep, said the Delta Force operative. Good to go.
One by one, the team all shook the truck driver's hand, thanking him. Then he climbed into his cab and drove off, while they disappeared into the woods and got ready for the most dangerous part of their mission yet. Chapter 72. On behalf of Lithuanian intelligence, Philip Landsbergis had done an exceptional job. The cow pasture drop zone notwithstanding, everything else had been perfect. He had provided a critical part of the operation, getting Harvath and his team into and out of enemy territory. Landsbergis's final piece of intelligence had been about where the team was now headed. Across the border checkpoint, along the shores of Lake Goldop, was a Russian campground. For all intents and purposes, it looked like a wonderful place to take a family. It had cabins, picnic tables, showers, toilets, a dining hall, a trading post, and a stage for skits. But for all its outward appearances, in reality, It was an underground railway stop for Russian spies. As they moved into and out of Poland, Lithuania, and other adjacent NATO countries, many of the spies came to the campground to unwind and be debriefed. It was a hangover from the KGB days, when vacation camps had been created to provide inexpensive holidays for officers of good standing. There was plenty of cheap booze and even cheaper women rotated in from neighboring Belarus a month at a time. American movies, dubbed in Russian, played in the theater while meals that sounded classy but were actually very low rent were cooked up in the vermin-infested camp kitchen. Over at the Russian Border Patrol checkpoint, the officers had been instructed to ignore the alcohol-fueled parties, as well as anything else that took place at the camp, if they wanted to keep their jobs. But those kinds of things usually happened at the height of summer. Now, it was off-season. Activity at the camp might just give the border guards something to pay attention to. It could go either way. Covering the distance to the camp was made difficult by Tretyakov's unwillingness to walk. They would shove him forward, and he would cooperate for a few steps, and then he'd go back to shuffling his feet. Harvath reached over and placed his fingers beneath the man's injured jaw. The area was so sensitive that the Russian's entire body seized. His eyes began to water, and he came right up onto his toes. It only took once to secure his compliance. There was no more slowing the team down after that. From where the Lithuanian had dropped them off, it was a full 10 kilometers to the border, but only 3 clicks to the campground. They proceeded in a staggered formation with their night vision goggles on and their suppressed weapons hot, ready for anything. Their hope, of course, was that they wouldn't encounter anything, that they would just move quietly through the campground and no one would know they had ever been there. That hope, though, was dashed the moment they set foot on the property. Coming up the road from the main camp building was a small Russian military unit. Sloan was on point and gave the signal for the team to melt into the woods. There, they all froze and didn't make a sound. Harvath had Tretyakov lie on his stomach. Crouching next to him, he placed his fingers under his jaw, a subtle threat of what would happen if the GRU officer tried to call out through the duct tape over his mouth, or if he made any sound at all. They waited for what felt like an eternity for the soldiers to pass. There were 8 of them, and they were heavily armed. From where Harvath and his team were hiding in the trees, it was impossible to make out whether these were regular troops augmenting the border patrol, or if they were a more specialized unit. Harvath didn't want to get close enough to find out. Getting Tretyakov off the ground, they pressed on. They had only been back on the road for a few moments when they heard a vehicle coming from behind them and were forced to return to the woods again. It was a truck carrying additional Russian troops, and it was headed into the camp.
"Damn it," thought Harvath. "They're flooding the zone."
Whether the troops were just bivouacking at the campground between shifts at the checkpoint, or were being spread out in a more organized fashion along the border, it didn't matter. They were standing between the team and their exfil. Stalin came over and crouched down next to Harvath. Keeping his voice barely above a whisper, he said,
"I'm guessing the plan didn't involve the campground being full of Russian soldiers."
Harvath shook his head.
"If I'd known, I would have brought more hot dogs."
"What do you want to do?"
"I want to avoid contact at all costs. I'm not really in the mood for another gunfight."
"Agreed," Stalin replied. "So, do we try to go around them?"
For the time being, it seemed like the only possible answer, and Harvath nodded. Getting Tretyakov to his feet, they changed course and pushed deeper into the woods. It made for even slower going. The ground was uneven, and there were plenty of hidden hazards. Rocks, roots, and downed branches to trip them up. But it wasn't as if they were swimming in options. They had no choice but to push forward. If they could get to the other side of the campground, there would be a small clearing to cross, and after that, Harvath prayed, nothing preventing them from getting to the water. Then, once they had reached Lake Goldop, they would head for Poland and freedom. But no sooner had the thought entered his mind than Sloan heard something up ahead. and gave the signal for the team once more to freeze. Chapter 73. Harvath tightened his grip on Tretyakov just as a barrage of gunfire erupted around them.
"Contact left! Contact left!" Sloan yelled.
Somehow, somewhere in the woods, the Russians had spotted them. Immediately the team returned fire.
"Move! Move! Move!"
Harvath ordered. Everyone, including Tretyakov, kicked it into gear. The wild, indiscriminate shooting seemed to be coming from every direction. The Russians were not only undisciplined, but were also going to end up killing one of their own. At that moment, Harvath heard a cry from Tretyakov's duct-taped mouth and saw him drop. He had been shot in the back of the leg. Slinging his weapon, Harvath helped him back up and forced him to keep moving. It was obvious that the Russian soldiers weren't planning on taking any prisoners. Whether they knew Tretyakov was with them was immaterial. They were throwing so much lead in their direction that there was no way they could expect anyone to survive. Raising his Rattler in his right hand, Harvath fired off a burst to their 3 o'clock. The soldiers pursuing them from that side responded, and Tretyakov was shot again, this time in his upper arm.
"Fuck," grunted Harvath.
They needed to find cover fast, or they were all going to be cut to ribbons. There were just too many guns on the other side of this fight. Through the branches up ahead, Harvath spotted what looked like the remnants of an old stone foundation, maybe from a caretaker's cottage or a previous lodge of some sort.
"There!"
Harvath shouted, directing his team to it. They all scrambled or leaped over the foundation wall. Harvath helped Tretyakov as Chase and Sloan laid down cover fire. Finally getting up and over, Tretyakov landed hard on the other side, followed by Harvath.
"If I had known we were going to be taking on the whole Russian army," said Stalin as he changed magazines, "I would have brought along a little more ammo."
Like Tretyakov, Harvath's exfil plan was shot to shit. All the work Haney and Barton had done staging dry suits, full face mask scuba gear, and propulsion devices was out the window. Even if they could get to all of it, it was highly unlikely they could successfully transport Tretyakov underwater to the Polish side of the lake where the boat was waiting. He was going to have to come up with another plan, and right now, there was only one plan he could think of. Activating his radio, he hailed Barton.
"What the hell is that for?"
Yashinsky asked, as the SEAL flipped open the storm case and removed a Mark 48 belt-fed machine gun.
"It's for you," he replied, quickly attaching it to its mount. "Did they teach you how to load and fire one of these things in the Polish army?"
"What are you trying to do? Start a war?"
"Actually," he replied, as he opened 3 ammo cans and then fired up the engine, "I'm trying to stop one."
Down the lake, they could hear the withering fire that Harvath and the rest of the team were under. Hailing Haney over the radio, Barton said,
"Good to go. On your mark."
"Roger that," Haney replied. "Stand by."
The SEAL looked back at Yashinsky through his night vision. He could see that she hadn't yet loaded the weapon.
"If we don't go, the Russians are going to kill them."
When she still didn't do anything, he pushed past her, loaded a belt of 7.62 ammunition, and charged the Mark 48. When Haney's voice came back over the radio and said,
"Now!"
Barton told Yashinsky to hold on as he pushed the throttle all the way forward. The engine of the rigid inflatable boat, or RIB, roared to life as they raced down the water toward the buoys and the demarcation line between Poland and Kaliningrad. The closer they got, the louder the gunfire became. Barton prayed that they would make it there in time. Up ahead on the western shore of the lake, he could see the Polish side of the border crossing. He could only imagine what the officers there were thinking as the gun battle raged across the water from them.
"Time to turn out the lights, Mike,"
said Barton, as he could see the buoy line rapidly approaching up ahead.
5 seconds,
Haney replied. And like clockwork, 5 seconds later, there was a detonation at the electrical substation, followed by smaller detonations at the generators that provided backup power for the Polish border crossing. At the buoys, Barton stopped only long enough to use a pair of bolt cutters to sever the line, before once again throwing the throttles all the way forward.
"Norsemen," Barton said over the radio, "we are inbound to you. 60 seconds.
The soldiers, having zeroed in on the position of Harvath and the team, had discovered some semblance of discipline and were pushing in with a coordinated attack in order to flank them.
"We're not going to have 60 seconds, he replied over his radio. "We're low on ammo and about to get overrun. Tossing out strobes. Hit them as hard as you can."
With that, Harvath activated two IR strobe lights and tossed them as far as he could in the direction of each advancing group of soldiers. Harvath, Ashby, Palmer, and Stalen then took turns trying to hold them off. They were all on their last rifle magazines. Barton had the Rib moving as fast as it would go. Approaching the shoreline of the campground, they could see muzzle flashes in all directions. It was absolute bedlam. Then, through the chaos, they pinpointed the strobes. There were at least 50 Russian soldiers advancing on the team's position. Barton swung the boat to the side and slowed, so that Yashinsky could strafe the Russians.
"Light them up!" he yelled.
For a moment, she paused, but before he could repeat the command, she opened up with the Mark 48 and swung it back and forth, cutting down every Russian in sight and littering the woods near the beach with their dead bodies. Back behind the stone foundation, Harvath and the team hunkered down as the heavy rounds from the machine gun crackled all around them. When Yashinsky had run the weapon dry, Barton came back over the radio and told the team to keep their heads down. They were reloading and about to make another pass. Seconds later, the Mark 48 lit up the woods again. When Barton came back over the radio, he said,
"On the beach in 20 seconds.
Transitioning to his pistol, Harvath looked at the team and said,
"Time to go."
Stalin transitioned to his pistol as well and helped get Tretyakov to his feet and down to the shoreline. There was sporadic gunfire as more Russians came through the woods, but Sloan and Chase handled it, dispatching several more soldiers. By the time they got to the water, Barton was already there. Loading Tretyakov, Harvath climbed in, followed by Stalin. Chase and Sloan helped push the Rib off the shore, and then hopped in and joined the rest of the team. As Barton punched the throttle, Stalin began applying pressure to Tretyakov's wounds. Harvath offered to take over on the Mark 48, but Yashinsky waved him off. Going hot, she lit up the Kaliningrad shoreline one last time, as the Rib disappeared into the darkness toward the freedom of Poland. Chapter 74. Governor's Island, Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire. 4 days later. Artur Kopech was still stunned. He didn't know how Lydia Ryan had done it, but the missile upgrade kits were gone, off the market. When he asked her about it, she had simply shrugged and said,
"We found a workaround."
That was it. She hadn't offered any further explanation. He had asked his man Wojciech to query his source, but Kushner didn't know what had happened either. His source had been as vague as Ryan. To her credit, though, Ryan had kept her word and had arranged a final visit for him with Reed Carlton. The old spymaster was a shadow of his former self. He had lost weight and had aggressively aged. Due to the combination of severe dementia and medications for comfort, Carlton was really out of it, so much so that Kopech wasn't sure if his old colleague even recognized him. He had come expecting to spend the entire day together, but instead decided to leave before lunch and catch an earlier flight back to D.C. He wasn't surprised that the visit had been supervised. Because of all the national security issues, Ryan had made it a condition. What did surprise him was who had done the supervising. Scott Harvath was Carlton's protege and heir apparent. Kopech had met the operative only a handful of times and had always liked him. He felt as if they had a bond. Though he was younger, he understood the great game and what was at stake. In fact, Harvath had spent a portion of their time together confiding in Kopech. Ryan, it turned out, had not been forthcoming at all. Carlton's rapid memory loss had crippled their organization. There was all sorts of information about spies and double agents that had been lost. Unlike Ryan, Harvath wasn't hopeful that the material would turn up in some yet-to-be-discovered journal somewhere in the man's personal effects. The most devastating thing, Harvath shared, was that in addition to Matterhorn, there were two more high-level spies feeding the Russians disinformation, whose identities would be taken to the grave with Carlton. It was a massive blow to NATO's anti-Russian efforts. There was much more that Kopech wanted to discuss, but he was cautious not to overstay his welcome. Harvath looked as if he had been through hell. Obviously, losing Carlton was taking its toll. They agreed to meet for dinner back in D.C., and Harvath walked him to the door.
"I'm sorry he was unable to interact," he said. "I know you had a long friendship. I'm sure he appreciates you coming all this way."
Kopech smiled and extended his hand.
"It is what friends do."
Harvath shook his hand.
"I hope you and I can be friends," the Pole said. "I think there's much that we can do together."
"I'd like that," said Harvath. "Very much."
"Then it's settled. We'll see each other back in D.C.
Harvath nodded and watched as the aging intelligence officer walked down the red brick path to his waiting town car. After Kopech climbed in and the vehicle had pulled out of the drive, Ryan came up behind him.
"How did it go?"
she asked.
"Exactly as the old man predicted."
She smiled. "Artur has no idea he's Matterhorn, does he?"
"Nope," said Harvath. "That's the genius of the old man. As soon as he learned Kopech was a spy for the Russians, he began devising a way to exploit him. You and I just took it to the next level."
"I played the part given me," Ryan replied, downplaying her role. "You're the one who took everything to the next level. Do you think he has any clue that there are no Griffins in Europe? That even the upgrade kits were phony?"
Harvath couldn't be sure. His whole plan had been to buy time, to knock the Russians off balance, and force them to reassess their attack. He had just needed long enough to figure out what the invasion would look like so NATO could put the right assets into the Baltics to stop it.
"Speaking of which," she continued, "General Dynamics says we can keep the fake upgrade kit their R&D department built for us."
He smiled.
"It'll look great in the conference room."
"It'll look better in your office."
Harvath nodded and made a mental note to send them a special thank you. Having something to prove the alleged existence of the kits, and thereby the missiles, was critical to his plan. The Russians didn't have to buy it 100%. They just had to be worried that land-based cruise missiles, some possibly nuclear-tipped, might have been waiting for them if they tried to invade. Looking out the living room's large bay window toward the lake, Ryan saw Lara coming back from her walk. Nodding in her direction, she stated,
"You two should spend some time together."
"We will,"
said Harvath, as he walked over to the sideboard and poured himself a bourbon.
"Let's finish up our business first."
Ryan's laptop, a stack of file folders, and myriad papers were strewn across the coffee table.
"Welcome to my office," she said, offering him a seat.
Harvath pulled out a chair and sat down.
"Where should we start?"
"How about we start with why Barton didn't fly back with the team?"
"He met a nice Polish girl, but it'll never last. She's too smart and has much better taste."
Ryan's smile broadened once more.
"Yashinsky turned out to be a good choice."
"She was excellent," said Harvath. "I'd work with her again in a heartbeat."
"The Supreme Allied Commander had a lengthy debrief with her, and the feeling's mutual."
"What are you hearing from the Baltics?"
"I've got good news," Ryan replied. "And then, I've got good news. Which do you want first?"
"How about we start with the good news?" he said, smiling.
"Nicholas knocked it out of the park.
He publicly exposed every fake Twitter and Facebook account that the Russians, through their hacker group Fancy Bear, were using to stir up dissent. He also managed to insert an undercover-style journalism team into the troll factory with hidden cameras. All of the television stations in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia are running specials, exposing how the Russians were trying to weaken them from within.
His sleeves are short, but there's always something up them.
Ryan laughed and continued.
As you know, as soon as you dropped off Tretyakov, Vela went to work on him.
How has that been going?
Very well. He has been able to extract a lot of information about how they plan to invade the Baltics.
Had planned? Asked Harvath. Past tense?
The Russians have canceled their training exercise and are actively repositioning much of their military equipment out of the theater.
They know we have Tretyakov.
They know someone has him, Ryan replied. And that's all that matters. Based on what we've passed along to Shape, NATO is already taking steps to shore up the weak points the Russians had planned to exploit in the Baltics.
That's great news.
Ryan agreed.
Yes, it is. You and your team did a fantastic job. But before we celebrate, there's a bookkeeping item we need to discuss.
What is it?
Chase and Sloan's expense report from Belarus.
What about it?
Harvath asked, slowly remembering that this was a part of his job he really didn't care for.
They were supposed to pretend to steal the crates of alleged missile upgrade kits and then use the old man's contact to smuggle them into Belarus.
Which they did.
Did you know that after dumping the bricks we used to weigh down the crates, they took all the smugglers out for champagne and steak dinners in Minsk? She asked.
Harvath laughed.
I didn't know that, but good for them.
We should give them a bonus for initiative. That's a valuable relationship we need to maintain.
Ryan didn't necessarily disagree. Faking the theft of the missile upgrade kits had been a key part of their strategy. Allowing the Russians to see the U.S. and Baltic ambassadors in a heated exchange at the U.N. was also part of their plan. It was all over now, though. The ends, as Chase had said back in Kaliningrad, had justified the means. Their assignment was to avert an Article 5, and by all accounts, they had done that.
There's one other thing, said Ryan, as she removed a sheet of paper and slid it across the table to him.
What's this?
The names of every cell leader across Europe in the People's Revolutionary Front organization.
Tretyakov gave this up?
He asked.
It came direct from the Solarium, Ryan confirmed. The list is yours if you want. Full expense account. No time limit.
Harvath looked at the names and the list of European cities. Then he lifted his head and looked out the window at Lara.
I'll take it, he said.
Ryan was surprised.
You will?
Pushing the list back across the table, he smiled and said,
No. Sloan and Chase should take it.
Are you sure?
I'm positive, he replied.
Like it or not, he was the spymaster now.
Give them a limited expense account and 3 weeks to finish the job. It's time to turn them loose and see what they can do.
Does that mean you're going to stick around? Asked Ryan.
For a day or two, he said with a wink,
as he stood up from the table and walked out the door to be with Lara. But outside, something was wrong. He could see it in her body language as he walked toward her. Before he even saw the shooters, he knew what had happened. Kopech had betrayed them.
Run!
Lara screamed.
Spymaster, a thriller, was written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz. The recording engineer was Noriko Okabe at Simon & Schuster in New York. Editing by Christina Pichano and post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Spymaster was produced and directed by Karen Pohman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Spymaster, a thriller, is available in print from Atria, Emily Bestler Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.